Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, an eyewitness account of how people are coping in Greece during this financial crisis. The talks drag on over Iran's nuclear program. Why? Trying to reach a middle ground in Libya. And minions clamor across the big screen.
Exploring who these guys are through history was a really kind of inspired choice, and then having them land in this really funny time period.
Coming up right here on The Voice of America. All eyes in the financial world are focused on debt-ravaged Greece and what's going to happen there. Joining us on the live from a square inside the capital, Athens, is our reporter Henry Ridgewell. And we were concerned today, Henry. How are the people there faring with all this going on?
Well, it's a very dramatic time for Greeks. As you can imagine, the last week has seen capital controls on the banks, queues at ATMs, people only able to withdraw a maximum 60 euros a day. And they've had the referendum on Sunday and now an 11th-hour meeting to decide their economic future. So you can imagine there's a lot of nerves here. Everybody's keeping an eye on the news, seeing what's going on, wondering if the coming days will see them exit the euro currency and return to the drachma, or if their Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras and his negotiating team in Brussels will be able to pull off some kind of deal with the creditors. But of course, as we know, over the past 6 months, those negotiations with the Germans, with the French and the other creditors in Europe have not gone well. The negotiating style has been very different on each side, and that's caused some abrasive reactions on each side. And this really is being seen as the last chance. Tonight, the meeting in Brussels, I think people across Greece will be glued to their television screens, glued to their radios, to see what the result of that could be, and it will have far-reaching consequences for this country.
How are businesses functioning in Athens? How are they getting along day to day?
With some difficulty. Most report that they are able to trade, although, as you can imagine, people have less cash in their pockets, quite simply because of those limits on cash machine withdrawals. So trading is a little bit down. Some banks have restricted card payments as well. So although tourists and locals can use their credit cards and bank cards for transactions, the companies that take those transactions aren't always able to access the money that they've taken from the likes of Visa and MasterCard and other companies. Otherwise, they're coping with the situation admirably, really. It is peak tourist season as well in Greece. Remember, it's one of the most popular countries to visit for people around the world. So there are thousands, millions of tourists in Greece as we speak, both in Athens and in the famously beautiful islands further south from here, and they are coping fine. We have spoken to the tourist industry here. The tourist boards say that some bookings are slightly down, about 10 or 20%, but it's holding up okay, and their message has really been, Greece is open for business. Come here, have a good time, and spend your euros and help us out.
I heard that vote on Sunday where they said no to the EU bailout, that opened old wounds in Greece.
It did, indeed. It opened wounds between rich and poor, between left and right, between the haves and the have-nots, if you like, that hadn't really been felt for a couple of decades. Greece has had a very turbulent history over the past decades, of course. Military coups, juntas in charge, obviously one of the poorest countries in the Second World War, which suffered greatly at the hands of the conflict there. And those old wounds that were developed in the 20th century really have been exposed here. One can just look at the map, which was produced in many of the newspapers following the referendum, of the geography of the voting. The richer areas of Athens voted for the EU bailout. They wanted to take that deal that was offered by the EU. They didn't want to take any chances of leaving the euro currency. They could obviously weather the crisis far better than the poorer people. But you go into the poorer districts here, places where up to 75% of people voted against the EU deal, and you ask them why they did that, why they risked leaving the euro currency, and they say quite simply because they've got nothing left to lose. There's been 5 years of austerity here. People are destitute. Some people are struggling to eat. The healthcare system is dysfunctional in many aspects. People can't get the medicines they need. And so it's understandable when you speak to people like that, when you ask them, why did you vote no to more spending cuts, more austerity from Europe? And they say, it's quite simple. I've got nothing left to lose.
Well, thank you very much, Henry, for your eyewitness account of what's going on there in Athens.
Good to speak to you, Susan. Thanks.
International Edition's Michael Lippin is looking online to see what reaction is there to the Greece crisis, and he joins us at the anchor desk. Hi, Michael.
Hey, Susan, how's it going?
Okay.
So, I've been looking at what people who use the hashtag Greek crisis are saying about it on Twitter, and I noticed that the U.S. ambassador to Greece has made a few comments in the past day. The U.S. diplomat's name is David D. Pierce, and that's also his Twitter handle. In one tweet, the ambassador said the U.S. has a highest level interest in a positive outcome to the economic rescue talks between Greece and its Eurogroup creditors. Pierce also said difficult compromises are needed from all sides. But, you know, he seemed to put the onus on Greece to do more, saying in another tweet that it's in the interests of all that Greece resumes reforms, returns to growth, and achieves debt sustainability within the Eurozone. Of course, that may not happen, and Greece could be forced to leave the Eurozone. But, you know, one analyst with the U.S.-based research group Council on Foreign Relations doesn't think that would be the end of the world. The Council on Foreign Relations sent out a tweet with a quote from that analyst, using its handle at CFR_org. The group quoted Sebastian Malaby as saying, "Greece's economy is smaller than Louisiana's." Louisiana is, of course, one of the poorest states in the U.S. So he said a Grexit, that's a Greek exit from the Eurozone, would not be a huge shock to the global economy.
Susan? Okay, well, thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
This is Voice of America, VOA.
Here's science in a minute.
Over a year ago, the European Space Agency's Rosetta spacecraft rendezvoused with a comet and has been keeping an eye on its activity, which is increasing as the comet moves closer to the sun. It's the comet called 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko, and Rosetta has discovered that some sinkhole-like pits on the comet might be responsible for a number of dust jets that are streaming from its nucleus and out into space. The space agency says that the sinkholes are providing scientists with an idea of what's going on in the comet's wild interior. By analyzing some high-resolution images taken by Rosetta's OSIRIS camera from a distance between 10 and 30 kilometers, scientists say they think that the sinkhole pits were formed after the ceilings of subsurface cavities became too thin to support their own weight, thus releasing the dust jets. A study detailing Rosetta's discovery has just been published in the science journal Nature. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
It's been announced that the P5+1 talks with Iran on its nuclear program will continue at least until Friday. International Edition's Jeffrey Young has been making the rounds trying to get some reaction to this development, and he joins us here in the studio. Hey, Jeff, what you find out?
Hi, Susan. I talked with Timothy Stafford. He's a research analyst at the Royal United Services Institute in London. And I asked him, why are we having a delay? Why this extra couple of days? And he had an interesting answer to share.
Well, the fundamental cause of the extension is that the parties have yet to be able to reach a full agreement on the nature of the terms being discussed. But the specific reason in this instance is that Iran has sought to broaden the agenda. So whilst there were outstanding areas in which the parties were not able to agree, particularly on the inspection of military sites, Iran has now sought to broaden the discussion to other areas that have not been previously discussed, particularly with regard to sanctions. So in addition to dealing with the problems that were already on the agenda, now there are an additional range of problems that the parties are going to have to resolve.
We do know that much of the discussion has indeed been focused on the lifting of sanctions against Iran and on what schedule that would take place. Now, there have been some reports that Iran wants its ballistic missile program taken off the discussion table. Can you elaborate on that and whether the P5-1 negotiators are willing to separate the two?
Yes, so the issue to consider here is that sanctions against Iran mainly fall within one of four categories. There are sanctions against Iran because of its nuclear activity, but also sanctions on its missile technology, its actions with regard to sponsoring terrorism, and for its human rights record. Now, the implicit agreement of the discussions up until this point had been that only those sanctions respective to the nuclear file would be phased out if an agreement was reached. Iran now wants those sanctions jeopardized and removed as well. And in doing so, it's broken the fundamental consensus that underpins these talks and made the agenda much more complex. Now, a number of the P5 countries, P5 plus one countries, are not at all interested in lifting anything with regard to the arms embargo or on missile technology. But Russia and China could potentially be interested in selling parts and arms. So in part, this is an attempt by Iran to split the P5 plus one negotiating parties and gain some more leverage within the talks.
Because you focus on this so directly and intently, a philosophical question. Critics of these Iran nuclear talks have been saying that Iran's scheme is to keep talking and talking while it continues to work on nuclear-related matters that might involve a nuclear weapon. Conversely, others say that the sanctions regime imposed upon Iran is so restrictive that Iran is motivated to conclude an agreement as quickly as possible to get the sanctions lifted sooner or later. Which way do you see it?
Well, there are definitely voices within Iran that would see it entirely differently. There are some on some side, there are some on the other. Now, for critics of the diplomatic process that's going on, the concern about covert activity is definitely at the forefront of their mind. But the more immediate concern is that Iran continues to pull these kinds of diplomatic tricks whenever a deadline approaches. It knows that the United States and its allies are keen for a deal and often keen for a deal at agreed time points. Firstly, it was June the 30th, then it was supposed to be today, July the 7th. And every time we approach one of these deadlines, it rapidly produces something else on its shopping list that it would like to have in the hope that it can try and secure more advantages than it was expected to secure. The problem with that, of course, is that it results in the entire diplomatic process being delayed and us moving on to further cycles of negotiations, which does not suit any of the parties that are actually at the table.
That was Timothy Stafford, a research analyst at RUSI, the Royal United Services Institute in London.
Well, thank you so much, Jeffrey, for stopping by.
Glad to talk to you. Good to see you.
Thank you. You too.
Thanks, Susan.
As the clock ticks on an Iran nuclear deal, we wondered if it is affecting oil prices. Joining us on the line from New York with an answer is our business reporter, Alexis Christophorus. Hey, Alexis, how you doing?
Hi, I'm well. Thank you, Susan. You know, if world powers and Iran do come to an agreement, it would give oil-rich Iran access to world markets and provide other nations with a guarantee that Iran will not produce nuclear weapons. Of course, the possibility of millions of barrels of oil flooding an already oversupplied market is putting pressure on oil prices, as you can imagine. A restart of a key oil terminal in Libya is not helping matters. Crude is down another 3%. Today to around $50 a barrel. That's after plunging nearly 8% on Monday, and some analysts are predicting we could see crude test a six-year low of $42 a barrel by sometime this summer. And for U.S. investors, we're seeing that they also don't have a lot of faith in the oil pits at the moment, and that's also putting pressure on prices.
Meanwhile, another day has made for another stock sell-off in China. What's happening there?
Well, despite China's best efforts to stabilize its market, we saw the Shanghai Composite drop another 1.3% today. And of course, the guaranteed way to stop the sell-off is to halt trading altogether. And you know what? That's exactly what some companies have done. A quarter of all companies listed on China's mainland exchanges have now suspended trading. The sell-off in China, as you can imagine, has reverberated around the globe. U.S. stocks have been mostly lower as investors look ahead to earnings season, which kicks off on Wednesday. They're already bracing for disappointing reports, and they hope for a rebound in earnings by the fourth quarter. Susan?
Well, thanks, Alexis.
Thank you.
The Libyan side that controls Tripoli, the Libyan capital, rejected the latest UN peace plan and said the amendments introduced in the fifth draft submitted by the UN did not include its proposals. The negotiators from that side refused to participate in the latest negotiating round in Morocco and asked for a few days for consultations. Their rival, the internationally recognized government in Tobruk, said it was ready in principle to endorse the text, so the long-awaited UN-sponsored deal is facing an uncertain fate. VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawy spoke with William Lawrence, director of Middle East programs at the Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy, about the different scenarios that could result. Mohamed?
He described what happened as a bad turn of events at a time the United Nations envoy to Libya was hoping to reach a deal at the beginning of the holy month of Ramadan more than 2 weeks ago. But Bill Lawrence was skeptical about the UN Security Council threatening to sanction those who threaten Libya's peace, stability, and security, or those who undermine the successful completion of its political transition.
I think the UN is trying to take a carrot and stick approach, but I'm a little bit concerned that offering carrots and sticks at the same time has a mutually nullifying effect. And I would wish that, in the middle of a negotiation, there weren't threats.
However, he believes that the UN is trying to put some pressure on the military factions linked to the two sides so that it might secure a political deal in the Morocco talks.
So what is next for Libya if the UN would not be able to achieve a national unity government as a first step?
According to Bill Lawrence, it can go both ways. But eventually, both sides have to compromise, as he said.
Everybody expects that we'll have continued hostilities for some time if the deal falls through, and it'll be harder to make a new deal if there's bad faith. And I think that's why there's an indication on the internationally recognized side that they're willing to wait several days up to a week to see if the other side will come closer.
There is a regional concern about security threats emanating from Libya, like terrorist attacks in Tunisia carried out by individuals who got their training in Libya. Also, Europe and the United States are worried about a failing state in Libya that becomes a safe haven for terrorist organizations like Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State group. So the international community will eventually exert more pressure to have a peaceful political transition in Libya.
Thank you, Mohammed, for this insight.
Thank you, Sue, for having me.
This is VOA.
This is Greenbee for a healthier planet.
I think that I shall never see a poem as lovely as a tree, wrote poet Joyce Kilmer. And while trees are indeed lovely, they are also key to life on Earth.
They provide critical ecosystem services, such as regulating the climate.
But says Rachel Peterson of the World Resources Institute, the Earth is rapidly losing its forests.
We're losing forests around 50 soccer fields per minute on average.
Peterson says land use change and deforestation in Indonesia, for example, account for 80% of its emissions. While the numbers appear dire, the good news, says Peterson, is a growing commitment by corporations to take the issue seriously.
Nestle and Mars and Wilmar, companies that produce some of our favorite chocolates and candies, commit to zero deforestation in their supply chains.
Peterson also notes there's been a recent decline in the rates of deforestation in Brazil's Amazon, possibly due to satellite monitoring technology that she says helps governments make better decisions on forest policies. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
Minions are small, yellow, pill-like creatures who have existed since the beginning of time in the world of fantasy. They are also the subject of a new 3D computer-animated adventure action comedy film. VOA's David Byrd gives us a peek.
The film from Illumination Entertainment, the creators of the Despicable Me franchise, starts at the dawn of time and follows the minions as they evolve through the ages, trying to find and to serve the worst of the worst.
Finding a master was easy.
A piñata!
Keeping a master. That's where things got tricky.
The film includes the voice of John Hamm, the star of the long-running, award-winning television show Mad Men. Hamm voices Herb Overkill, the husband of Oscar winner Sandra Bullock's supervillain, Scarlett Overkill. Hamm says that the arc of this story intrigued him.
Exploring who these guys are through history was a really kind of inspired choice, and then having them land in this really fun, funny time period that also happened to be relatively interesting to me was kind of cool.
The time period is 1968, when the Minions, Stuart, Kevin, and Bob, are headed to the Villain Con in Orlando, Florida, a convention of the worst villains around. And Bullock's Scarlett Overkill is the star of the show. She eventually gets Stuart, Kevin, and Bob to try to steal Queen Elizabeth's crown. But they soon find out that they have to save all of minion kind from annihilation. The minions hitch a ride with a seemingly innocent couple, Walter and Madge Nelson, voiced by Oscar nominee Michael Keaton and Golden Globe nominee Allison Janney. Janney has a special connection with the little yellow minions in their blue overalls. She went to college with their creator.
I
I went to college with Chris Meledandri, who's the head of Illumination, who, you know, who did all the Despicable Me's and the Minions, and so a dear friend, and he asked me to join the cast of Minions, and I was so completely honored and excited. And then I saw who I'd be voicing, the character of Madge, who was just deliciously, wonderfully evil in a not so evil package, in a very, you know, 1950s housewife package.
Allison Janney says that she regrets that in doing the animated film, she and Michael Keaton were never in the same room because their voice parts were recorded at different times.
But I only wish I'd gotten to be in the same room with Michael Keaton when we played these characters, because I saw him get out of a limo going to a pre-Oscar party, and he goes, "There's my wife." And I looked behind me. I was like, "Who are you?" And I realized he was talking to me. I'd forgotten that he had been cast as my husband, because we never got to act together.
For actor John Hamm, the project was something new after the end of Mad Men nearly 1 year ago.
It's been a fun year, you know? It's been a little work and a little vacation and then kind of a lot of press, because then the stuff starts coming out and we have to talk about it and tell people about it. So it's been fun. It certainly has not been a traditional unemployment period, I'll put it that way.
Minions also stars Oscar winner Jeffrey Rush as the narrator. Oscar nominee Steve Carell voices the young Gru, the villain that the Minions later work for in the Despicable Me films. Oscar nominee Stephen Coogan, currently the star of Showtime's Happy-ish, provides the voice of Professor Flux and the Tower Guard. The soundtrack features hit music from the 1960s, including Revolution by the Beatles, You Really Got Me by the Kinks, and Jimi Hendrix's Foxy Lady as Scarlet Overkill's theme song. I'm David Byrne.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Some 1.2 billion people survive on less than $1.25 per day. A dollar and a quarter is the World Bank's threshold that quantifies the minimum consumption and income level needed to meet a person's basic needs. Today, that figure is widely considered to be the international poverty level, and those who live below it, about one out of every six people, or 17% of the world's population, live in extreme poverty. Extreme poverty is more than just a definition with a number attached to it. It signifies unfulfilled dreams, lost potential to the broader community, and a tough, hardscrabble life. It means a lifetime of making impossible choices when allocating scant resources between food, medicine, housing, or education, because people living at or below the poverty level spend over 80% of their income on food and are unable to save money for emergencies. Still, over the past quarter century, the situation has been improving. Since 1990, the current figure of 1.2 billion people has dropped from 1.91 billion, an improvement of 43%. And today, we believe that we can lift 1 billion more people out of poverty by 2030. With USAID leading the way, the United States, in cooperation with our international partners, has worked hard to improve economic opportunity, health, food security, education, equality, stability, and accountable governance for millions of people. Today, for the first time in history, we have the tools, technologies, and approaches to end extreme poverty by 2030. This will not be an easy task. Still, it is possible, but only if we come together as a global community in support of this effort. So we must turn existing development capacities and priorities towards ending extreme poverty by, for example, increasing food security and improving child survival and improving education. We must invite people across the world to come up with new ideas and innovative solutions to old and persistent development challenges. And we must boost economic growth and connect people to the global economy. If we can do all that, if we accelerate our progress and focus on key turnarounds, we believe we can all but wipe out extreme poverty within the next 15 years.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.